Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Hometown Ghost Stories contains serious and often distressing events and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
This week on Hometown Ghost Stories, in 1974, thousands of people crowded a small Connecticut suburb street to catch a glimpse of the paranormal activity occurring in what many consider to be the world's most haunted house. This is episode number 50 of Hometown Ghost Stories, The Lindley Street Poltergeist, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Monday, November 25th, 1974, Bridgeport, Connecticut. It had begun to rain outside. Jerry watched as his 10-year-old daughter, Marcia, played Monopoly on the living room floor with Barbara and Paul. It was her favorite game. Marcia felt safest with Paul and Barbara around. When Marcia felt safe, Jerry could typically relax a little. But not today. He had that feeling again. It started with tightness in his shoulders, and then throughout his whole body, as he felt the atmosphere become heavy. Nobody else seemed to feel it, so Jerry tried to shake it off, but he knew something was about to happen. He knew there was a dark force at work in his home. Marcia, who was lining up the little Monopoly houses on the carpet, suddenly looked up as the fluorescent light started to flicker. Something that was normal in cold temperatures, but they were in their living room, and the thermostat read 70 degrees, so there was no precedent for the flickering light. The Monopoly game came to an abrupt halt as the framed painting of The Last Supper came crashing to the floor. Marcia screamed, and Paul jumped to his feet. Jerry looked over at Paul, who looked back, both seeming to acknowledge the feeling in the air. The pressure of the heavy atmosphere felt like it moved past Jerry, and the four people in the room watched as the couch moved on its own, turning about 35 degrees. Something extraordinary was taking place. Jerry heard his wife Laura sobbing from inside the bedroom, but nobody could move. On the other side of the room, the air began to shift as a cohesive assemblage of smoky yellowish-white gauzy mist materialized. At first, it was an indistinct cloud, but as they watched on in a state of amazement and fear, it began to separate into four distorted, transparent figures. Barbara gasped and made the sign of the cross with her hand. "What's that smell?" Marcia cried. Jerry thought it smelled like sulfuric acid or ozone from a generator. Jerry was suddenly overcome with an uncontrollable feeling of anxiety and began humming in a very low tone. The other three people in the room looked over at him, confused, perhaps not recognizing his voice. All of a sudden, he began reciting a Gregorian chant in Latin. He chanted the Mass of the Dead and the Mass of the Angels, which is recited when a child dies. Marcia was crying and clung to Paul's leg as the rain pounded against the windows. Jerry's anxiety inexplicably turned to rage as he began reciting louder. The four misty figures seemed to grow, almost as if they were feeding off his energy. One of the figures moved towards Paul, who instinctively stepped in front of Marcia. As he did so, the smoke bumped him. He felt it physically, as if it had a tangible structure, knocking him off balance. Suddenly, Marcia was lifted and physically tossed across the room. The girl screamed. Paul ran over, scooped her up, and all of the terrified people in the house ran outside into the stormy night. I'm Dave Wilkins, and this is Hometown Ghost Stories, The Lindley Street Poltergeist, Bridgeport, Connecticut. Settled in the mid-17th century as part of the township of Stratford, Bridgeport incorporated as a town in 1821 and a city in 1836. While early settlers farmed and fished, they soon took advantage of their location on Black Rock Harbor and shifted from an agrarian community to a mercantile and manufacturing hub. Throughout most of its history, Bridgeport remained a quiet suburb town, but in 1974, it reached a level of infamy that nobody could have seen coming. It became home to the most well-documented case of poltergeist activity ever. Not long after their wedding in 1960, Gerard and Laura Gooden purchased their home on Lindley Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Gerard, better known as Jerry, was a Catholic man who had been a maintenance man for 23 years and was considered a straightforward, down-to-earth guy, not known for having his head in the clouds. Laura was a full-blooded Native American who grew up in a home where no other children her age lived nearby. Because of this, she had a hard time making friends, but her and Jerry made for a very compatible couple. They welcomed the birth of their son on Halloween in 1961. He seemed like a perfectly healthy baby in every way until one day their neighbor pointed out that his head would always seem to hang down. Laura had noticed it before, but hadn't put much thought into it. At first, the doctor said it was nothing to worry about, but after 6 months and no changes, Jerry Jr. was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. The Goodens spent nearly all of their time and money on the child, ordering him a special chair and leg braces, but he would only live to the age of 6, passing away just 3 days before his 7th birthday. This naturally devastated the couple, and to make things worse, the day after the burial of their son, Laura needed to have a hysterectomy to remove a tumor, leaving her unable to have any more children. The grief was unbearable. The Goodens kept a shrine to their son in the living room for about 6 months until they decided that a home without a child wasn't a home at all. They took down the shrine and went to inquire about adopting a child. They immediately fell in love with 4.5-year-old Marcia, a full-blooded Seneca Native American girl who was the youngest of a family of 9 and the only one of her siblings put up for adoption. The Goodens cared dearly for their new daughter, and the only criticism neighbors seemed to have is that they were very overprotective. Laura wouldn't let Marcia out of her sight, walking her to and from school and refusing to let her play with other children. This led to Marcia not having any friends. When asked about it, Laura said that since she grew up without friends, she didn't see the need for them. She also said that she wasn't going to let Marcia out of her sight for fear that she would die. This caused Marcia to resent Laura. Things started to get bad when Jerry's hours were cut back at work. Marcia had to be transferred from a private school to a public school where she was relentlessly bullied. The kids would call her horrible names and make racist remarks about her Native American heritage. One day she was attacked and beaten by a group of boys, one of whom kicked her so hard she needed to be placed in a pelvic brace. Laura and Jerry immediately pulled her from school and decided to homeschool her, effectively cutting her off socially. Marcia wasn't the type to lash out. She would keep her emotions bottled up inside. Paranormal experts agree this is the prime condition necessary for the invitation of a poltergeist. It all started before the family even realized anything was happening. Objects would go missing or would be found out of place. These events were usually chalked up to coincidence, but in 1969, several years before the haunting went mainstream, came the first real incident that caught the attention of the Goodens and family members. The Hoffmans were family friends to the Goodens and would often come over for game nights and other gatherings. They had a daughter, Rosemarie, who was close in age to Marcia and was probably the closest thing she had to a friend. The duo would often sit on opposite sides of the couch in awkward silence. One day, while the adults were conversing in the kitchen, Rosemarie and Marcia sat on the couch in the living room. Rosemarie tried to make conversation, but Marcia didn't know what to say, so remained silent. Suddenly, the couch rumbled ever so slightly. "What was that?" Rosemarie asked. Marcia said nothing, but looked frightened. The couch rumbled again, a little harder this time. The girls exchanged a look of panic as Rosemarie's end of the couch slowly rose into the air about 6 inches before crashing back down with a loud thump. The girls shrieked, causing the adults to come rushing into the room. Neither of the frightened girls could articulate the events that occurred, so the adults brushed it off as nothing. Somewhat surprisingly, this event sparked an increase in interaction between the girls. They became closer and even began playing together in the yard, rather than sitting on the couch in silence. One afternoon, the Hoffmans came over for a visit, and Rosemarie ran into Marcia's room to find her sitting on the couch with her legs crossed, rocking back and forth, talking softly in a language she didn't understand. "Marcia," Rosemarie called in a panicked voice. Marcia snapped out of it and looked at her friend. She explained that she had been talking with their grandfather, who was displeased that the Goodens had taken her from their tribe. From 1971 to 1972, Jerry was repeatedly abruptly awoken by loud pounding on the side of the house. It was not a knock at the door, but rather a deafening slam against the side of the house. Again and again and again. He couldn't identify where the sound was coming from, night after night. Eventually, he called his friend and neighbor, John Holsworth, who was a police officer with the Bridgeport Police Department. John suggested they make a recording to show to the police. They set up a tape recorder at 3 a.m. and proceeded to record the pounding. It started in the kitchen and followed John and Jerry throughout the house as they walked room to room. They presented the tape to the police department, who, along with the fire department and various other city officials, investigated but were unable to determine the cause of the pounding. The intermittent pounding continued through 1974, when things again became worse. One early autumn evening, Jerry and Laura sat in their living room when Laura suddenly jumped up out of her seat. She pointed to the window, where they both saw the image of a disembodied hand on the other side of the glass. They ran out the front door to investigate, but found nothing outside the window. On another night, Laura heard three loud knocks on the front door. When she opened it, nobody was there, but she looked down and saw two wet footprints on the stoop. A chill crept down her spine as she realized the footprints were of bare feet, and it was a completely dry evening. Early autumn turned into late autumn, and on November 21st, things yet again grew worse. Jamie and Janet Holsworth, John's wife and 14-year-old daughter, were over visiting with Laura and Marcia when there was a crash in the master bedroom. When they rushed in, they saw that the window had been broken from the inside. The interior pane was shattered, but the outside pane was untouched. Nobody had been in the room. The next day, Jerry, Laura, and Marcia sat in the living room watching TV when they heard strange sounds coming from the master bedroom. When they went in to investigate, they saw that the window shade had been rolled up and the curtain had been flung from the rod. Jerry replaced the items, only to watch as they were again thrown from the wall as they watched on in horror. Jerry joked to try and lighten the mood. "Whatever it is, it doesn't like curtains," he joked, but nobody laughed. The following day, November 23rd, the family went on a day trip. When they returned, Jerry found Marcia's TV, which had been high up on a shelf, face down on her bed, with the cord and antenna wires hanging from the back. Confused, he left the room to find Laura. As he walked into the kitchen, he saw dishes floating out of the sink and flying around the room, smashing off walls. Laura walked into the doorway just in time to see all the knives float out of the knife block and fly towards Jerry. She called out to him, and he ducked out of their way. Just then, the kitchen table slowly rose off the floor and flipped over, sending all of the groceries crashing into the wall. Laura heard something behind her and turned to see the 300-pound refrigerator hovering a foot off the floor. Immediately after that, the heavy wooden TV stand next to the sink tilted, sending the TV toppling off the edge, smashing down on Laura's bare foot, bursting two of her toes. She screamed in pain. Jerry scooped her up and instructed Marcia to get into the car. He carried his wife to the car and brought her to the emergency room. While they were away, chaos at the house continued. The following day, Officers Carl Leonzi and Joe Tomek were on patrol when they received a call regarding unusual activity at a house on Lindley Street. When they arrived, they found the Goodens and several other family members, including their fellow officer John Holsworth, in a very distressed state. They explained to the officers that a couch had lifted off the floor and slammed back down. Dishes were flying around and smashing. The refrigerator had lifted off the floor and bumped into John, and the recliners were violently reclining and unreclining in rapid succession. The officers entered the house, and Officer Tomek picked up the TV set and put it back on the bureau, where it sat for a moment, and then, to his astonishment, proceeded to float up into air and swing left to right like a pendulum. He looked around to see if something were propping it up, but found nothing. The officers witnessed many other unusual things and called for backup. One policeman, Officer Leroy Lawson, witnessed a crucifix pull itself from the wall, nail and all, and projectile itself directly into his chest. It bounced off, and Officer Lawson exclaimed, "That's it, I'm out of here." Several other officers arrived along with 10 firefighters, including Assistant Chiefs Messina and Paul McKenna. They all witnessed the TV rise up and flop over. A crowd of people began to gather outside the house as word of the haunting got around. Mary Pascarella, a neighbor, made her way through the crowd and into the house. Mary was a psychic medium and wanted to test the theory that a child can act as an unconscious agent for poltergeist activity. The tests were unsuccessful, but Mary had another idea. A year prior, in 1973, Mary had performed a séance in Harrisville, Rhode Island, with the famed paranormal investigators Ed and Lorraine Warren. She called them after leaving the Gooden's house and filled them in on everything. They took an immediate interest in the events and made the short trip to Bridgeport from their home in Monroe. When they arrived, Ed had to park 4 blocks away due to the thousands of people crowded around the house. The Warrens brought along a priest by the name of Father Charbonneau and a 21-year-old seminary student named Paul Eno. They began interviewing the policemen, firemen, and other witnesses. The Gooden family welcomed the help, and Marcia remarked that it was fun having so many people in the house. Ed took Paul aside and instructed him to stay with Marcia at all times, partly to ensure her safety and partly to make sure the girl wasn't causing any of the paranormal activity intentionally. Ed then called the police superintendent and informed him that there was poltergeist activity in the house. During the course of the Warrens' investigation, they, along with the policemen and firemen, witnessed endless amounts of paranormal activity, including recliners rising up to the ceiling, the family cat swearing and making off-color remarks to some of the policemen, furniture moving, an ashtray levitating in the air and exploding into shards of glass, and mysterious banging sounds. Lorraine Warren would experience nausea when entering Marcia's room, and while sitting at the kitchen table with the Goodens and Paul Eno, they noticed a burn appear on her hand near her wrist. The crowd outside continued to grow, and by now included several news reporters. The police had barricades set up, but some of the people would sneak through and peek into the windows, catching glimpses of the furniture floating around. Father Charbonneau and Ed believed they were dealing with a demon and wanted to perform an exorcism, but the Monsignor at the church didn't agree. Despite the lack of cooperation from the church, Ed and Lorraine left the house to head back to their home in Monroe to gather items necessary for an exorcism. While they were gone, the Goodens, Paul Eno, and a family friend, Barbara Carter, saw the entity manifest in the form of 4 smoky figures. The 5 people who experienced this ran outside. Paul ran through the crowd to the neighbor's house to call the Warrens and inform them of the incident. They returned to the house around 9:15 p.m. and proceeded to the basement with Father Charbonneau to bless the house. While they were down there, the priest noticed an odd-looking shadow in the corner of the basement. He approached it and noticed that the shadow wasn't on the wall, but standing a few feet in front of the wall. He could completely walk around it, and when he passed his hand through it, it felt like a cool mist. He asked Ed and Lorraine if they could see the entity, and they nodded. They were convinced it was a demon. The following evening, November 26th, Officer Mike Costello was posted at the Goodens' house. He sat in the living room with Marcia and her parents. Officer Costello witnessed a few abnormal occurrences with the recliner Marcia was sitting in, but was suspicious that she might be causing them herself. 2 other officers knocked at the door, and Jerry got up to let them in. While Jerry and Laura were talking with the officers, Officer Costello saw Marcia move her leg out and push the TV a few inches with her toe. Just then she caught his eye, and he gave her a gotcha look and smiled. He quickly phoned the police superintendent, who was eager to wrap up the Lindley Street fiasco, and informed him that he believed the whole thing was a hoax perpetrated by the girl. The superintendent urged Costello to interview the girl and get her to admit to it. In a subsequent interview with officers Costello and Del Toro, Marcia admitted to many of the unusual occurrences, including moving the TV, faking the cat's voice, and toying with the recliner. She also admitted she witnessed Lorraine Warren burn her own hand intentionally by holding it under hot water. After the interview, the police left the house and officially ruled it a hoax. This is when things went from bad to worse. Without the police presence, the crowd, which was estimated to be around 4,000 people, was unrestricted, and people piled onto the lawn. News reporters began reporting on the hoax, blaming Ed and Lorraine Warren, and accusing them of drugging the family with candy laced with hallucinogens. The family had a hard time leaving and returning to the house with the unruly crowd. One person even grabbed at Marcia, tearing a pocket off of her shirt. On another occasion, two men were arrested and charged with attempted arson for lighting the house on fire with the family still inside. Luckily, somebody noticed the smoke and the fire was extinguished before it got out of hand. The men claimed they were trying to rid the home of evil. After that, the police re-established a perimeter to ensure the safety of the family, but would not entertain any further claims of paranormal activity. Ed and Lorraine Warren vehemently denied claims of a hoax, quoting, "No 10-year-old child weighing 70 pounds could have created such a hoax in full view of policemen and firemen for that length of time." Despite the Warrens' denial, the Goodens demanded they leave the property at once. Eventually, the hype died down, but things didn't get better for the Gooden family. Jerry was harassed at work, and the family was financially unable to replace many of the items that were destroyed during the incidents. The paranormal activity hadn't stopped either. The family had gone along with the hoax story in hopes that the crowd would lose interest, but the haunting never stopped. Furniture continued to float around, and objects would continue to smash against walls. New officers who hadn't been to the house, but were called to the house, witnessed the strange happenings as well. In mid-December, the family left the house for a getaway to New York. They left the house in pristine condition, but when they returned, they found it completely destroyed, with all of the furniture overturned and their beloved statue of Madonna lying on the floor with its thumbs removed. Laura believed that the force was getting stronger and wanted to kill the family. Shortly after, a paranormal investigator named Boyce Beatty reached out to the family, and on December 18th, he, along with several members of the Psychical Research Foundation, began a scientific investigation of the house. They interviewed the family, Ed Warren, and Inspector Clark, who was the police official responsible for closing the investigation and declaring it a hoax. Everyone interviewed, including Inspector Clark, agreed that they did not believe it was a hoax. Clark was pressured to close the case by his superiors and took Marcia's cursory admission as a chance to alleviate the police from public scrutiny. The interviews wrapped up in January of 1975. The Duke University abstract contained a preliminary report entitled "A Perplexing Poltergeist." They conducted a series of psychological tests on the family members and determined them to be of sound mind. They determined the phenomena to be genuine and that the events occurred in full view of witnesses and eliminated all other possible causes. The Lindley Street case would end up being the best documented case for poltergeist activity in history.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome into Hometown Ghost Stories, episode number 50. We made it to 50 episodes, ladies and gentlemen. We did it. I'm happy. And thank you to everyone in chat who has been there. If it wasn't for all of you and everyone who listens to the podcast and everything, we definitely would not have done 50 episodes. But we're here now, and we're back. We're back for 50. It's October. Spooky season is raging on, and we are investigating the Lindley Street poltergeist. I'm joined by Rob Coakley. What's up, Rob?
How long do you think that I could prop Dave's corpse up as a Halloween decoration before people actually realize that it's his corpse?
It is the only time of year that you can do that. You do that around Christmas, people might get a little suspicious. Although, throw a little Santa hat on them.
Yeah, a little beard.
Yeah.
Put them in a sleigh.
Paint that beard white. Yeah, we're also joined by Dave.
What's going on? I think the Halloween being like an excuse to get away with murder is something that I feel like could be so much bigger. Like I always like, we used to go to like these haunted houses, right? And you'd see the guy come in with a chainsaw. I'd be like, with a chainsaw. I'd be like, man, what if some crazy dude just went into a haunted house with a chainsaw? Like everyone would be like, oh no. And then just get, you know, hacked to pieces or something. So
there's some really fun Halloween movies or horror movies that are based upon that, where like things are actually happening in the haunted house that people go to. It's like, oh, this is really great. It's just people actually getting like hacked up by chainsaws and stuff. I've seen a few movies and I always enjoy them. Some of them are bad, but they're still like those trashy, fun, bad ones.
Yeah. I've always said this. Like, have you guys gone on like a haunted hayride?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I always think that, like, here's an idea for anyone that runs a haunted hayride who may be listening.
Have you guys heard of Halloween?
Have actors on the hayride pretending to be people. And forgive me if this idea has already been used, but
it's been done.
Has it where like people run up and just pull those people right off the hayride?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, well, thanks for spoiling all the fun, but I thought I had a great idea.
Yeah.
Turned out I didn't. Also, I thought I had a good idea last episode with the Coliseum. And it turns out that was the plot for some movie. I think I got called out in chat by Matthew Thomas or someone. So I hadn't seen that movie, but I thought I had a good idea going there. But we don't have to go back to that.
Right. We do horror movies. That's it.
That's true. Yeah. So welcome to everybody who's hanging out in live chat for the episode 50 celebration. The Church of the Stephanies cult leaders are here. Steven, Matthew T, Facebook user, who I'm assuming is Jackie and Tommy. She still just pops up as Facebook user. So welcome in, Facebook user, if that is you, and everybody else is hanging out. We appreciate you guys. Lot of content coming out this month. We dropped the one of the editions of the History of Ghosts. So if you guys check that out on YouTube, a lot of this content is on YouTube. We're going to be pumping out more horror movie reviews and everything. So we're working hard for you guys this October. It is an exciting
month. I will be dead by the end of the month, probably.
Yes, and we'll have no space left on our computers to store all video files.
Computers will also be dead.
Yeah. So, anyways. So this case is good. This is like Enfield Poltergeist Part 2, basically. I mean, obviously, it had nothing to do with the Enfield Poltergeist, but so similar to that case where you had everything from the idea of it being a hoax, it involving the children, people thinking that the kids are pulling off a prank, the Warrens being involved. I think they were more heavily involved in this case than they really were in the Enfield case, but we already went over all that. Very similar type situation, and it's another poltergeist, and this one has some compelling stuff and some very interesting stuff. We always say on this show that we appreciate when a haunting has different kinds of hauntings, and you can go down the list, but we have a swearing cat, and we have a stump of a statue stealing poltergeist.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you just turn to the Fonz? What is happening up in that corner?
I had to show the thumbs on screen. In case people needed to see what thumbs look like.
Yeah,
I still have my thumbs. Poltergeist hasn't stolen my thumbs yet.
One had a couple of unique things. Obviously, I had a lot of the same things. You get the moving furniture. You got the knocking that, you know, starts off with a knocking and the banging, but then it escalates to swearing cats. And there's a set of whispering swans. There's also that I didn't mention.
So. Just want to reference the chat real quick. Rachel B says she made it, missed the whole story, but just made it. So the first thing she's hearing is about whispering swans and swearing cats. And if that's how you're coming into this episode, you must be like, what the hell is going on? But continue.
So, So those were two things. So the whispering swans thing came. I didn't mention it in the opening video because I was trying to keep it under, you know, an hour.
It's like a long story. Trying to keep it scary. That's just... Whispering Swans sounds like a traveling group of acoustic violin players.
It's definitely like a hotel in the Berkshires or something like that. Come stay at the Whispering Swans.
Yeah, bed and breakfast or something. Yeah.
Whispering Swans Resort. Yeah.
The Whispering Swans Reading Room. Like, that's what it sounds like.
So the swans were two like stone swan statues that the family had on the front, like either side of the front porch of their insanely small house. I don't know if you saw, if you're just listening, you didn't see the pictures. You can go Google this house. It's the size of a shed.
Dave's doing a renovation on his house. All of a sudden, he's going to
shaming everybody else's home.
I'm going to leave.
I didn't realize you lived in a peasant dog house.
I have water pouring in every single room of my house right now, so I can't talk shit. literally running down the walls.
It's still amazing to me that your office has remained relatively intact. Because
it's insane. The rest of my house is studs and just drips of water like a horror movie. And like this room is like untouched. Thank God.
You have a set. Like you
people
have
who are watching are like, he's lying. There's no, he's not really renovating his house.
Yeah. If your webcam wasn't attached to your computer right now, I'd say do a quick little walk around, but you don't have to. Yeah.
I can't. No, I don't want to risk the connection issue either.
Yeah. I mean, to walk 3 feet, it's not going to work out.
So just to wrap up the Whispering Swan thing, because it's stupid, all the people who crowd, like this house gathered like a very large crowd, which is not a common thing that happens in hauntings. And all the people that were outside kept saying they heard the stone swans whispering. So that's what that was. It was never like verified. So the unverified whispering swans, basically.
Unverified whispering swans.
And the talking cat was debunked. That was one of the things that the girl ended up admitting that she was doing. She was faking the voice. And kind of a funny thing about that is the cops were going along with it. So at one point in the house, because the house was, once the haunting was reported to the police and the fire department and all sorts of investigators were living at the house and were just there, you know, day in and day out. So the cops were messing with this other cop because the other cop was like, I got to hear about this talking cat. And his buddies pulled the girl aside ahead of time. They're like, hey, this cop's going to come up to you. And he's going to ask you about the talking cat. Tell him the cat said his brother's name is Frank. So the cop comes over. He's like, and he covers his name badge. And he's like, hey, does your cat know my name? And she goes, no, he didn't say your name. But he said to say hi to your brother, Frank. And the guy's like, oh, get me out of here.
it's a solid prank. At least they're doing good pranks.
I mean, you got to still have fun with it, right? Even if you're being haunted, I would definitely still like do stuff like that.
Try to make light of the situation. Just to go off topic for a second, Stephanie says, speaking of books, Sydney's 11th birthday is November 27th. She's wanting true ghost story books. I've been looking, but I haven't really come across too much. Any recommendations, please? What is the one that you would recommend, Dave? Is it Coast to Coast Ghosts?
Yeah, actually, I think that's probably a good one for... an 11-year-old. Some of them. So the Coast to Coast Ghosts is written by a cop who did a lot of crime scene. So I would want to, if I were you, I'd read that one first. And then if you think it's appropriate for an 11-year-old or
12. The one that I brought up on, she said it's her 11th birthday. So she'd be turning 11. The one that I had brought up about the Enfield one seemed like a pretty harmless book. It was, This House is Haunted. I mean, all this stuff would have scared the hell out of me when I was that age, but I mean, she seems to be into it since she watches the show anyways.
If you're into this stuff too, another good set of books is the weird books. Like I have the weird Massachusetts book. I'm sure there's a weird Tennessee book where it's just full of a bunch of stories that include ghost stories and other things around your state. I'm not going to 100% say there's a weird Tennessee one, but I would assume there's one for almost every state.
I think they do one for all the states. We got the weird New Orleans one, which was pretty good too.
Yeah.
So with that being said, let's get back into the haunting. So we had, we've moved on from the Whispering Swans, which by the way, this was brought up.
Clearly we haven't. We've been bringing it up for 20 minutes now.
He said 4,000 people heard Whispering Swans. It's like, if you have such a crowd outside, like how are you going to hear a statue whispering? So I don't know.
But it's a fun one. I think that they, the crowd was like, they weren't all packed into that tiny front yard. They were all over the street and everything, and you couldn't park on the street. And they had like snack stands set up, like people were selling snacks to each other and whatnot. It was pretty crazy. You don't hear about stuff like that a lot. So this was one of the things about this that set it apart from the others. And what the other thing people were doing is, so the police had a barricade set up in the front yard, right? They weren't letting people onto the property, but you know, there's so many people, they can't keep track of it all the time. People were sneaking in and going up to the windows, and they said there's several witness accounts of people saying they just saw furniture flying around and crashing into walls through the windows. Who knows if that's people just, you know, fanatics just saying they saw something to have a cool story, or they actually saw it, because it's hard to tell with this one, because this one kind of reminds me of the Vallecas case, where you had the police that also witnessed the haunting. Mm-hmm. And I give the, you take the police as sort of like, almost like an objective, you kind of buy it more, right? Because the police, there's their jobs to be, to rule out the crazy people, right? And you have a dozen witness accounts of police officers and firefighters high up, like assistant chiefs and deputy chiefs of the fire department there, that were like, yeah, we saw this. And this book that I based it, this episode on, which is The World's Most Haunted House, mm-hmm. It's just filled with quotes from police officers and firefighters that witnessed this stuff that say that I will never forget it, you know? And it's pretty crazy.
That's always compelling. And not to keep going back to Enfield, but the same thing with Enfield, you had police officers that witnessed, and that was how the case started getting taken seriously, was once the press had heard that police had verified hauntings going on at the house, and that's where it kind of snowballed and when it was taken seriously and validated, basically. So,
right. not even just because they're cops though, but because they're a like impartial third party. Right. Like they're just a random group that are coming to the house, right? So, I mean, it's going to be cops or something to that aspect that are coming, but any impartial third party that's coming there that can validate what's going on, I would say is very helpful to the case.
Right. So like Dave said, like, I wouldn't trust people who go up to the windows like, oh, I saw something move. It's like, well, you might just be trying to get a rise out of the crowd or something, or you're just trying to feel special. I wouldn't trust, I mean, not that I don't trust the Warrens and their track history, but they're going there looking for ghosts. You know, they want to find ghosts.
Right. That's why
I believe what they say. And this is why I'm agreeing with you. Yeah. And, you know, even the psychical research people, I mean, they're also there to look for ghosts. I mean, they're also there to partially debunk it as well or validate it. But that's why it's like when it comes to police officers or an impartial party, I think that brings more validation to the case.
Yeah. I mean, there's the psychical research team that came in from Duke University to actually like study this to determine whether or not they think it is actual haunting. They are trying to debunk it. Like that's their job. It's their job to like, you get an A+ if you can debunk this, because they want these people, you know, they believe it, they're all in, but they want real stuff. They don't want to be, they don't want to be taken lightly.
Yeah. They're not doing it for like a network TV show. They're not doing it for a wacky YouTube video or clickbait or anything like that. So that makes sense.
You want to stop calling us out?
They're not us.
I forgot we're a wacky YouTube channel. Sorry,
boys. I'd like to say that we call a spade and we call it bullshit when we see it. I think we're pretty good at that.
We call a whispering swan statue a whispering swan statue.
We do. Mm-hmm. So, and on that topic, I usually have the Warrens back. I usually try and, you know, you go back to the Amityville episode. I did a whole thing where I, you know, went after the debunkers of the Warrens and of that case there. This one isn't it for me. I've actually been referencing this Lindley Street case since I think episode one or two, mm-hmm. as to what, like, this case is one of the reasons why I'm not all in on the Warrens. And it's because of when Lorraine Warren got caught burning her own hand under hot water. So that was one of the things that the girl admitted to the cops who were interrogating her about what she said she saw. Now, she did claim that she faked more things than she could have. She said she faked the levitating refrigerator, which these refrigerators in 1974 weighed about 300 pounds. So there's just no way. If a room full of police officers, firefighters, and adults saw a levitating refrigerator, there's no way that a 10-year-old girl is faking that. It's just impossible.
I don't know how anyone could fake that.
You can't fake it. And that was another one of the quotes in the book, was just you can't fake some of this stuff.
Like, even if you have like me, who has no problem lifting a 300-pound refrigerator, right, like if I were to lift it with my wonderfully strong, definitely not defective arms and unbelievably strong legs and back, like you would see, all of a sudden you just see my feet. Like, you know, I'm lifting up the fridge, you know, my arms are around the front of the fridge. How are you lifting up a fridge without being exposed?
What I'd like to say real quick is, I don't really take your word for this, Jesse, as I watched a magician do the same trick to you about 15 times the other night, and an equivalent of him just throwing something over his back and you just freaking out every time. Oh, I'm glad you finally know how, by the way. And I'll be back in a second.
By the way, I can do Rob's connection is getting weird. He said that cursed chair finally worked out for you, Dave.
Oh, the cursed chair. Perfect.
Yes. Not only did I know how he did it, I learned it myself and I pulled it off on my kids the other day. So I can fool kids.
That is good.
That's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
I'm a magician. Add that to my bio.
Yeah. So what Rob was referring to is when we were in Block Island, we were at a restaurant after, and there was this magician who followed us around all night showing us magic tricks. He was pretty good. He was a good magician.
He's very good.
Yes. Also not a normal occurrence to have a magician follow you around for an evening.
But, okay. So I got to know. All right. So this was during our Block Island trick. And as soon as Rob gets back in here, we'll discuss this further. But he had asked us for a ride from one bar to the next bar because this is a small island. Everyone knew what everyone was doing. We just met this guy. He's like, oh yeah, I heard you guys are going to this bar after. We're like, yes, we are. Okay. Word gets around fast around this small island. So he was the magician and we knew this. They have one magician on the island and that was him. Cool guy. And also named Rob. So we're at this bar and he's like, okay, can we get a ride to the next bar? We're like, sure. And we're waiting in the car for him. We're like, where is this guy? And then like, we didn't see him. We're like, whatever. He'll figure out a way. So we drive to the next bar. And as a joke, I'm like, how much you want to bet? Like when we get there, like, because he's a magician, he's just going to show up. He's already there. And sure enough, we walk in and he walks out of the bathroom and we're like, oh man, he did. He just showed up out of nowhere. And then he's like, oh yeah. He's like, the trick is if you go into the bathroom at the other bar, you come out of the bathroom here. We're like, oh, I wonder, do you think he planned that all along?
I don't know. Maybe. He's an illusionist. He's an illusionist. That's what they do.
I told that story to someone at work and he immediately was like, oh dude, he planned that from the beginning. I was like, ooh, maybe he did. Maybe he did. Mm. And I moved by the magician yet again. That was like one of the four times he got me that night.
400 times he got you that night.
Let's move
moving
on.
So the Warrens, Lorraine Warren faking getting her hand burned. I believe that. I believe she did fake that. And I don't think that everything the Warrens do is fake, but I think that in a lot of these cases, they like to pump them up for the media attention. Now they always brag, like, when we go on these cases, we don't take money. We're helping these people free of charge. But the reason they're doing it is to boost their names for fame. That way, when they do these lectures, they can go to these colleges and get paid massive amounts of money for these lectures because they have the big name that they create by going to these cases and pumping them up. So I do believe that while a lot of what they do was legitimate, and they would go there and kind of basically pump these things up, which is a lot of what you see these kids doing, like in the Enfield case. And in this case is the kids are getting all the attention. They're enjoying the attention. So they take something that might be real and they just add to it by, you know, pushing the TV with their foot a little
bit.
They're
also kids, but when they're getting attention for something, they keep doing it until you inform them, like, hey, it's not funny anymore. You know, they'll just keep it. Like if a kid says a funny joke and everyone laughs, they're going to keep saying that joke over and over again because like, oh, it worked. They think I'm funny. You know, it's just how kids react. And I could see that, especially if you have a case. How long did this haunting go on for?
This haunting went on from, I think it went on for 6 or 7 years. So it started in the mid 60s. It got, and then, you know, 1971, I think, was when the two girls were on the couch and the couch started levitating. And then 1974 is when it went like really big when the Warrens got involved and everything. So it went on for a long time, but it wasn't really crazy until those last couple months in 1974.
The couch levitating had a happy ending though, because at that point, the kids were very awkward. One of them just didn't even talk, right? And then the couch levitated. They experienced that haunting together, and then they became like really good friends after that, right?
Yeah, for a short period of time, and then she became reclusive after that, and that's when she just basically had no friends. And part of it was because the mother wouldn't let her have any friends. The mother was, I think, doing her best, but this person was not, I think, mentally ready to adopt the child because she had just lost her other child and was just not ready. She wouldn't let the girl out of her sight, wouldn't let her have friends because she was afraid she was going to die. So
I can see that. Yeah.
It was a really unfortunate situation for, I think, somebody that, you know, genuinely meant well. But
it's understandable. I mean, imagine like obviously the mental toll it takes on you to lose one kid. And then if, you know, on your second run around, you're like, I'm not screwing this up. So, I mean, I could see how that would be. Obviously, it's not the best way to raise a kid, but, you know, who am I to say? It's just, unimaginable grief that I never want to deal with. So it's rough.
Yeah, exactly. So back to the poltergeist thing. Have you guys heard the poltergeist theory of why, of like where, what they are. So the psychical research, the psychical researcher Frank Podmore proposed the naughty little girl theory for poltergeist cases, many of which have seemed to be the center on, seemed to center on an adolescent, usually a girl. He found that the center for the disturbance was often a child who was throwing objects around to fool or scare people for attention. And that's the skeptical theory, but the parapsychological theory is that when you have an adolescent teenage girl, that they have a troubled adolescent female girl, right? An adolescent teenage girl that's troubled, that negative energy is what manifests the poltergeist. So that's why I think you see a lot of these cases like Enfield, like Linley Street, with the troubled teenage girl.
Yeah, you know, it's always that energy. Age too. So yeah, if you look up like the definition of poltergeist, or look up different theories on when they're created and how they're created, it's usually girls around that age when they're going through puberty. And it's the same thing with Enfield, same age group, same situation going on there.
Exactly. And I don't know why it's specific to females, because I guess teenage males have lots of built up negative energy also if they're troubled. But I don't know. I didn't write the theory. That's just it, and it exists.
We don't make the rules.
We don't make the rules.
Someone on Wikipedia does.
Exactly. What are your thoughts on this one, Rob, as far as hoax or legitimate?
I think the problem lies with anything else. So where you start having some perceived hoaxes and you're able to debunk some of it, then you get the problem of people trying to debunk everything, which is fair. Obviously, you should be trying to debunk everything. But we still have cops to this day from that time frame that say that they saw stuff that they can't explain. And again, how were they making some of this heavy furniture levitate and stuff? So it feels like it's another one just like Enfield, and we keep going back to it because it's so paralleled, that stuff might have happened and then people might have just added on to the legacy type deal, because people want, again, people peeking in the window. They want to be part of the story, right? Everybody always wants to be part of the story. So they are adding to it like, oh, I saw this. And then you almost feel under pressure too, right? Like I sort of felt this at the house in Bridgewater. I never did anything to like make stuff happen, but like we would bring people in like to the house, some of our friends, and we'd be like, this house is scary. You know, stuff happens. And it's like, well, what if nothing happens this night? Because not every night things that we had experience would happen. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's kind of a letdown to those people if they don't experience it.
Yeah. So I remember we were up there in the attic one time doing the whole ghost investigation thing, and everyone was like terrified. And then all of a sudden there's like a slam on the wall behind me. I'm like, oh my God. And it was just fucking Keith who just threw a battery just to mess with us. I mean, these things happen, you know, like if you can get people riled up, it's going to happen. Happened at the Conjuring house. Like one of the, one of the people that worked there like banged on the wall when he was coming downstairs because he was a tool. And I immediately was like, dude, don't do that. That's not what I'm here for. I'm like, I'm actually trying to find some legitimate stuff. I don't need you doing that. Please fuck off. And that was kind of the end of it.
Right. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm like, it probably started off as legitimate and there's some legitimate stuff, but you muddy the waters when you start doing stuff just to expand upon the story. So that's what I think it's legit. I just think we need to be careful about which evidence we think was legit and not legit. Too legit to quit.
Thanks, Rob. It's difficult when you do that. No, it's difficult when when there's a few instances of the kids pranking, because then everyone wants to write everything off. And it's, you know, when it's verified that, you know, she was moving the TV stand with her foot or whatever, pretending that the cat can talk, it's difficult to not then say, well, this whole thing is a hoax because we caught her messing around. But it's like, you cannot debunk the furniture. You cannot debunk the fridge behind this girl. You know, you would have to have multiple family members, police being involved with this for it to be an actual hoax. Don't say that.
Right. And the police, when they declared it an official hoax, that was the brass up top coming to the lower guys saying, wrap this up. Like, we're wasting way too many resources here. This crowd is out of control. We need this to get we need this to end. So the first time they got one little thing, which was just her pushing the TV with her little toe, they were like, that's it. That's what we need. Get her, get the confession out of her, get this to be a hoax, get it wrapped up. And that's what they did. That's exactly what they did. They just, they said she admitted to the cat. She admitted to moving the TV. It's a hoax. And
I can see that too. So it's like from their angle as well, it's like, they just want this thing to go. They got 4,000 people crowded outside of this house. They have to do police detail. They have to pay these officers to be out there. They have to take time away from other cases that could definitely use their attention to go deal with this. If it wasn't for the massive crowd, I don't think they would have been so quick to try to write it off.
Yeah.
Right.
And we all know those police details ain't cheap. So
it's true.
That's the other thing with that. So I think that's what it is too. So that's where I stand on it with all the stuff I was looking into on this case. It's like, I think it's legit, but then you have all the other stuff along with it. And that's what ruins some of the stuff, right? Like the whole name of the brother thing as a joke, that's fine because it's just a joke. You're going to tell them afterwards, like, no, the officer told me to say that and everything. And can you block Bree real quick? Thanks. but when you're going to the lengths of burning your own hand or causing stuff like that to occur, then you are doing more harm than good and trying to, A, help the family. That should be the number one priority, right? If it's that bad that, you know, they're constantly getting all their possessions broken and they don't have the money to replace this stuff, that should be your number one priority, is to help this family in some way to get it to stop. And B, you should be looking at realistically, like trying to find a way to study this to understand it better. But now you've ruined all that. You've tainted the experiment or whatever.
Yeah, what was Lorraine's story after she got called out for the burning hands situation?
She denied doing it to herself, and the rebuttal to that was no, we were sitting at a table with five other people that all saw the burn appear on her hand. So it was with the people that she was sitting at the table with were like the people that worked for them. So it's, you know, like a Paulino came with them. Father Charbonneau came with them. So, I mean, I don't know if like the priest was in on it, but I think most likely, this is just me taking a guess, is that she did burn the hand under the hot water. The girl did see it, because that's this oddly specific thing for a girl to, you know, for the girl to make up. And she probably had it hidden under her shirt sleeve and then said, oh my hand, there's a burn on my hand. You know, just all, everyone's like, oh wow, that's crazy. There it is. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, how hot can you get that water? I mean, I know the water from the sink can get hot, but is it going to be that hot to actually leave a burn?
Maybe she saw her pour it out of a tea kettle. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, props for dedication there, I guess, but I don't know.
Got to go all out. Yeah.
Matthew Thomas brought up a good point earlier in the chat. I want to see if I can find it. He said, what if the ghost was the child that died and was mad and felt replaced by the adopted child? That was actually one of the theories in the book. And it was like, they just kind of glazed over it real quick and then moved on. And they were like, no, it's demon. No, it's a poltergeist. But I'm like, that was a pretty good angle, I guess. Yeah. You know, the kid feels like he's replaced or something. And, you know, who knows how. Maybe he's a jealous ghost. I don't know. But I thought that was a pretty good angle that they kind of just...
I didn't even think of that. That is very interesting, because it lasted the whole time that child was in the house, right? Because the thing I saw was, even as like the publicity of this thing died down, the haunting didn't die down. The haunting lasted well beyond that. So they even tried to sell the house at one point.
Yep. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I don't think they were able to sell the house from what I heard.
Yeah. So it was a weird time that the 70s was, you know, in the satanic panic, nobody wanted to buy a haunted house. I was just going to say, like, it's too bad they weren't trying to sell it now, because they could probably sell it for $50 million, because everybody wants to buy that haunted house so they could rent it out for ghost investigations. Right. But back then, nobody wanted it, you know?
Because the house still stands today.
The house is still there today. The Goodens are dead, the parents are dead, and the daughter, as soon as she turned 18, she moved back to Canada to find her real family, and no one ever heard from her again.
She also died. They found her. She died as natural causes at 51 years old.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. I looked into that earlier today. She disappeared for a long time when they were writing the book. He was trying to find her. Never did. They ended up finding her. Oh, my God. I forget where. It might have been Canada. But, yeah, they ended up uncovering that she died of natural causes 2015, I think sounds right. So,
yeah. I'm not going to do that math, so I'll take your word for it.
Well, that's a sad ending to the story.
That is a sad ending to the story. It was a sad ending to the story anyway, that she just moved out when she was 18 and went back to find the family. The family that put her up for, she was one of nine children, and they only put her up for adoption, which is just crazy. I don't know what I mean, but then she went back. She's like, I got to find this family. It's like, maybe you shouldn't. I think I think you chalked that one up in the loss column. But I don't know. Maybe she found them. Maybe it worked out. Who knows?
The mother had a...
The mother anyone up there tragic, with eight kids, I guess that's a number right there.
The mother had a tragic end. She died in a car accident in like 91, I believe. And then the father died of natural causes in like 94. My years might be off, but that's roughly the timeline.
Yeah, that's pretty rough. That is pretty rough, but I think so. That sounds right. That sounds pretty much exactly what I had heard. So this one and Enfield are like the two biggest poltergeist cases that you can find if you're looking into them. And this one claims to be the best documented. I saw a couple people in the chat earlier when I had said best documented poltergeist story ever. They were like, wait a minute, what about Enfield? Enfield was how long was Enfield? 18 months long there. The haunting. Yeah. It's like the actual haunting was longer in Enfield, but this one was researched by universities and, you know, on site doing the tangible research, finding evidence. So that's, I think, why they consider it to be the best documented case. Enfield being the number two.
And then you also have the Edinburgh one at the Greyfriars Churchyard. That one only has a couple hundred, though, like documented poltergeist things. Only a couple hundred.
Wait, what?
Enfield had a couple thousand, I believe, that were documented. But
A couple thousand what? What are you?
Paranormal instances. So okay. Yeah, Morrison Gross that they had or Morris Gross and Playfair, they had documented there's 2,000 things happening, like chair moves.
So I don't think that's how they're measuring like what is the best documented. So it's not like 1,000 things happened here versus 100 things happened here. I think it's how many different researchers researched this case and found tangible evidence.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
So I think that's the metric they go by.
That's fair.
Yeah. So it's a hell of a story. It's a great one for our 50th episode, I think. A little milestone for us here.
I know it is. This one and then 52, I guess, would be the big milestone.
That's a year. 50 is more fun.
I do like this little interaction between Matthew and Ricardo where Matthew said most documented ever. And Ricardo said, why did I hear that in Jericho's voice, Matthew? Which is fun because we're recording with Chris Jericho this week.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. Part two of the Chris Jericho podcast. It'll be fun. Yeah. All right. Anything else on this case, gentlemen?
I think that about covers it.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah. That is a good one. Very different one.
Do we want to hit some of our 5-star reviews for the week?
Yeah.
All right. So we got two this week. So the first one is from B. Crane. It's titled A Really Awesome Podcast. By far, one of the best podcasts, period. The first part of my shift, I work alone, and I've always dreaded it. Since finding Hometown Ghost Stories, it has made those 4 hours very enjoyable and look forward to going to work and listening to the podcast. Weirdly, that one kind of hit me a little differently. I love all of our reviews, but that's just like the genuine spirit of that one. It's like, man, people really do like the show. So I want to just say again to everybody, thank you for listening, because it's amazing. We're approaching a year, and I think we've grown a bit bigger than we even anticipated to be in a year. So we want to thank everybody that has been here to join us.
Yeah. Welcome in, Julie. She says, happy 50th. Just found this channel/podcast. Love it. Thanks, Julie. Welcome.
Thanks, Julie. Welcome.
The other one is from Ashy Nicole. Amazing show. I absolutely love this show. I've been listening to it all day at work for the past few weeks. Hearing some of the history behind these places makes the stories that much more interesting. Then listening to the guys talk and joke after is the best. Definitely giving me a great list of new places I want to visit. Us too. There's so many places that we've covered that I need to get to. Whether it's the Sally House, I want to get to Australia to go to Junie. It doesn't end. Every time we do a place, the castle we just covered last week, it's like, oh man, I kind of want to go to England just to see this castle now.
Go hit that castle, visit the Swansea Devil.
Yeah. Like, there's so many cool stuff. And if you live in an area with some stuff like this, everybody does. A lot of people put off going to do this stuff. They're like, oh, I live so close, I can do it anytime. Go do it. A lot of people fall into that trap. You'll go to places. You can come to Massachusetts, right? And people around us will be like, oh, I love going.
You can stay at Rob's house.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see what Gotham says about that. But people in Massachusetts, people that we know that have lived there their entire lives, will be like, we love going to Salem. And they'll be like, I've never been. We're like, it's an hour away. How have you not been to Salem, Massachusetts? You live an hour from it. It is one of the most historical places in our entire country. How do you not go check this out? Like, so I think that happens. Like, it's just things are so close to you that you just overlook it. Don't do that. Go out, see these things. Have a lot of, like, bring your friends. Just have a, you know, have a ball. Go and experience this stuff.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many haunted locations are in every single state. And like in the world is changing with these things too. It's like before it was like, oh, there's that haunted house, but you know, it's all blocked off and they don't allow people. Now it's like a lot of these locations are not only welcoming people in, they're doing tours, they're doing overnight stays. They've turned it into, you know, like the Lizzie Borden house. You can just book a room like it's a hotel. Like there's so many places like this, or you have haunted hotels if you can't find one near you. So there's always something. Real quick, let me thank our patrons. We have our VIPs. We have Jimmy H, Justin T, Lisa J, Mom and Pops Wilkins, and Stephen V. For other ones, we have Jake V, Mike B, Stephanie A, Sydney B, Church of the Stephanies, Anthony Angry Dave Rocks T, Brandon W, Captain McSlugs, Cody G, Kiralee J, Mark M, Matthew T, Mariah M, Papa Squatch, Rachel B, Sarah, Dave Loves Bacon R, Sarah Wilson, Soph M, Hooper, and I think that's it. The list was in a different order this week, so it kind of threw me off, but I think I got everybody. So thank you guys. If you're interested in getting your name in the credits and read out by me like this sometimes, for as little as $3 a month, you can jump in on Patreon. For the $10 and up tiers, we're having another Patreon pre-show hangout, which has been a great time. Every week we have a good amount of people that hop in there and we hang out and just talk about whatever. Usually we just hold our dogs in front of the camera and it's a good time. So yeah. And we watch Stephanie's kids climb all over. It's good. Yeah. It's good stuff.
Good stuff.
What's next week?
Next week we are doing Fox Hollow Farm, a little serial killer / haunted location, which should be an interesting one. So I'm going to be in Florida next week for the Universal,
Halloween Horror Nights,
which is going to be awesome.
That's the thing I need to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited for that. So I'm going down there. I'm going to be doing some live streams from it. So you guys can check out, do a little walkthrough on some of those things. And, we'll see how it goes, man. We're going with the kids. So I don't know how we're going to handle these haunted houses. I think the only way we're going to be able to do it is me and the wife are going to have to go in one at a time to these haunted houses, which sounds 10 times more scary. So I'm going to be going solo to these haunted houses. I'm not going to skip it, man. This is like some of the best ones in the world.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You can't skip.
Just drag the kids in.
Frankie, you want to go?
Frankie will appreciate it.
Frankie probably would. So either way, yeah, we'll make it happen. It's going to be a good time.
Are you going to not be here? We can talk about this off air. Are you not going to be here Tuesday?
I will not. I'll be in Florida. So I'm going to try to tune in from Florida. I'll bring stuff to do so. But I don't know. I don't know what my situation is going to be. So it might be like a little cameo appearance, but I don't want you guys to have noises of Universal Studio in the background the entire episode. So that wouldn't be great quality. Matthew T brought this up, and I think someone else brought it up earlier. Says you guys should do a live in-person audience episode. So that's in the works with Bloody Disgusting or Bloody FM, the network that we signed with. So we've been talking about setting up different live things, everything, and everything's kind of mumble jumbled right now because it's October and that whole network is crazy in October. And the other thing that he had brought up was do it for episode 100. That would be a really cool episode 100, is do an in-person episode.
So if you're in Massachusetts or in the general area, me and Dave are going to be doing a live talk on during a ghost tour on Saturday night this week. So if you're interested in that, I can get you in contact with the people to get tickets for that. But the tickets are limited, and I think they're close to sold out. So if it's something you're interested in, you'd have to be close to Bridgewater, Massachusetts. That's where the ghost tour is going to be. It's very – that's why I haven't been pitching it too much, because it's so specific to just here, and it's not our thing. So, yeah, if that's something you'd be interested in, we are going to be talking on there for about 20 to 30 minutes.
Brodad brings up that Frankie, that's my son, he says Frankie won't even go into his grandbrother's closet with the scary dollies.
Have you seen the dolls?
That sounds terrifying. Yeah. I wouldn't want to go in there either.
Yeah, it sounds awful.
Better haunted house than the regular
one. I won't go into the closet.
Yes. So, yeah, that's good. And then we have our Salem episodes coming up the following 2 weeks, which... this is what's going to kill us as we try to put all this together.
That just stressed me out. This. Yeah. So we got to figure that stuff out. So we got a lot coming up. So, So we'll be back Friday. We're going to drop, I don't even know at this point. We're doing Curse multiple episodes a week. So we're going to be dropping Cursed Possessions. We're going to be dropping a horror review and probably a history of ghosts as well. So just stay tuned. Yeah. There'll be content probably like every other day. Going forward, so we'll see. So there's gonna be a lot of stuff. Keep an eye out. If you're in the Discord, you'll get notifications on everything that we upload. So, and then
This Friday will be a Barbarian review.
Barbarian review. Patrons get the week ahead for the Cursed Possessions.
We've made this so confusing.
We have.
There's gonna be stuff. Look out for the stuff. Join the Discord if you want live updates on this stuff. And obviously on Patreon, you'll get the stuff before other people get the stuff. That'll pretty much do it, gentlemen. Anything else?
No, on top of all that stuff, we're dropping even more stuff on Patreon. So, like, if you're a Patreon member, you get a few more things.
More stuff. And on Patreon, you get ad-free stuff. That's a new thing. So, for all tiers, you get ad-free episodes. So, I know that there isn't many ads. I know YouTube just always has ads, but on the podcast, you've probably noticed one or two sprinkled in here and there. But to get those ad-free, Patreon, boom, no problem.
Yeah.
Anything else, gentlemen?
That's going to do it for me.
Thank you all for tuning in to episode 50 of Hometown Ghost Stories. Many more to come. We'll see you next time.
Peace.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.